Well, it is good to see each of you this morning. I want to ask you to open your Bible up to the book of 2 Samuel. We have made it to chapter 10 of our study. And I want to cover all of chapter 10 and grab verse 1 of chapter 11 while we're at it. We'll deal with verse 1 of chapter 11 in a fuller detail next Sunday, or I plan to anyways. But I want us to look at chapter 10 in its entirety, because we looked at chapter 9 in its entirety. And in chapter 9, we saw the wonderful passage of Mephibosheth, the recipient of God's grace. And in looking at that, that is probably one of the most beautiful grace passages in the Old Testament. In the book here of 2 Samuel, in chapter 9, Mephibosheth is saved from fear, he's saved from death, he's saved from obscurity, he's saved from a life of being at odds with everyone else in his country, and it's done so wholly and completely by the miraculous grace that David bestowed upon him. And David said and sought out Mephibosheth that he might show the grace of God unto him. And so it's very clear from chapter 9 that Mephibosheth is the recipient of unmerited grace from David, and David being a symbol and a dispenser of grace in much the same way that God is to those whom he saves. I find it interesting that chapter 10 records this narrative. We go from Mephibosheth, the recipient of God's grace, now to chapter 10, Ammon, the rejecter of God's grace. In chapter 10, we are going to see the exact opposite happen. We're going to see David extend grace, and we're going to see grace rejected. And so God here in the narrative of having 2 Samuel recorded for us lays back to back how he saves those whom he saves, and how he proclaims the good news to those who reject and despise him. And so I want to look at all 18 verses, and I just want to grab verse 1 out of chapter 11 so we can bring the rejection of grace that Ammon experienced all together. So let's read these 19 verses, and then I have, 7 points. We'll make them all short, though. How about that? Fair? Does that sound fair? 7 short ones better than 5 long ones, isn't it? Y'all have seen me deal cards before, haven't you? All right. Let's read verse 1, and we'll go through the end of the chapter. And it came to pass after this that the king of the children of Ammon died, and Hanan, his son, reigned in his stead. Then said David, I will show kindness to Hanan, the son of Nahash, as his father showed kindness unto me. And David sent to comfort him by the hand of his servants for his father. And David's servants came into the land of the children of Ammon. And the princes of the children of Ammon said unto Hanan, their lord, thinkest thou that David doeth honor thy father, that he hath sent comforters unto thee? Hath not David rather sent his servants unto thee to search the city, and to spy it out, and to overthrow it? Wherefore Hanan took David's servants, and shaved off one half of their beards, and cut their garments in the middle, even to their buttocks, and sent them away. And when they told it unto David, he sent to meet them, because the men were greatly ashamed. And the king said, tarry at Jericho until your beards be grown, and then return. When the children of Ammon saw that they stank before David, the children of Ammon sent and hired Syrians of Beth Rehob and Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 footmen, and the king of Maacah, 1,000 men, and of Ishtob, 12,000 men. And when David heard it, he sent Joab and all the host of the mighty men. And the children of Ammon came out and put the battle in array at the entering in the gate of the entering of the gate, and the Syrians of Zobah and of Rehob and Ishtob and Maacah were by themselves in the field. When Joab saw that the front of the battle was against him before and behind, he chose to all of his choice men of Israel and put them in array against the Syrians. And the rest of the people he delivered into the hand of Abisha, his brother, that they might be in array against the children of Ammon. And he said, "If the Syrians be too strong for me, then thou shalt help me. But if the children of Ammon be too strong for thee, then I will come and help thee. Be of good courage, and let us play the men for our people and for the cities of our God, and the Lord do that which seemeth him good." So Joab drew nigh, and the people that were with him unto the battle against the Syrians, and they fled before him. And when the children of Ammon saw the Syrians were fled, then fled they also before Abisha and entered into the city. So Joab returned from the children of Ammon and came to Jerusalem. And when the Syrians saw that they were smitten before Israel, they gathered themselves together. And Hadarezer sent and brought out the Syrians that were beyond the river, and they came to Helam. And Shobak, the captain of the host of Hadarezer, went before them. And when it was told David, he gathered all Israel together and passed over Jordan and came to Helam. And the Syrians set themselves in array against David and fought with him. And the Syrians fled before Israel, and David slew the men of 700 chariots of the Assyrians, 40,000 horsemen, and smote Shobak, the captain of their host, who died there. When all the kings that were servants of Hadarezer saw that they were smitten before Israel, they made peace with Israel and served them. So the Syrians feared to help the children of Ammon anymore. Chapter 11. And it came to pass, after the year was expired, that the time when kings go forth to battle, that David sent Joab and all his servants with him, and all of Israel, that they destroyed the children of Ammon and besieged Raba, but David tarried still at Jerusalem. So it is clear from our text that David sent grace, or tried to administer grace, to the children of Ammon, and they rejected his offer. They didn't just say thanks, but no thanks. They actually assaulted the ambassadors that he sent there. They sent them back in shame. And so I want us to look at seven things from this text and help us to understand those who reject God's grace and what happens to them. Verses 1 and 2, ambassadors sent. In verses 1 and 2, David sends ambassadors. Just look at it with me again. "Came to pass after the king of the children of Ammon died, and Hanan his son reigned in his stead." So we have a death here. David is probably already dealt with the death of his dad, Jesse. We don't find any mention of Jesse in 2 Samuel. So we know that more than likely David's father had passed away. We don't know how he passed away, but I would venture to say he probably did some running from King Saul, just like David did some running from King Saul. David sent his parents into a foreign land where they would be safe for a time. But David knows what it's like to lose a loved one. He knows how hard that is. David knows what it's like to be a new king with the old king passing away. And David is going to be gracious to Hanan because his dad Nahash was kind to him. Look at verse 2. "Then said David, I will show kindness unto Hanan, son of Nahash, as his father showed kindness unto me." Now, the Bible doesn't tell us how Nahash was kind to David. It doesn't tell us. We have no idea. That is not recorded in Scripture. A lot of people speculate different things, but this we do know. Nahash wasn't always kind to Israel. This same king who had passed away went to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and surrounded them, and they said, "Hey, we want to call peace." He said, "I'll give you peace under one condition, that you let me put out the right eye of every man in your town." Now, what kind of peace terms are those? Hey, we surrender, okay, but it's not over until I put out everybody's right eye. This guy was a wicked king. But David was gracious to him. Even though he was the enemy of Israel for large portions of time, David at some point in time had received some friendship through Nahash. And so when his son took power, David says at the latter part of verse 2, look, David sent to comfort him by the hand of servants for his father. So David sends out ambassadors. These are men that are of esteem. These are men that David is sending out to be the mouthpiece of King David, to be the ambassador of Israel. We know what it means to have ambassadors. We have ambassadors in nations all across the country who negotiate and help us find peace and work together with other nations. And so this ambassador, these men that went out to do this work, were sent out by David and were representatives of King David and all of Israel. So they went into the city or the region of Ammon for the purpose of expressing David's condolences for the death of his father. I bet they carried gifts, just like we do when someone passes away. We send over chicken and potato salad and a fruit and meat tray and a fruit and meat and cheese tray, and we send over fruit. We send over all kinds of stuff for people to eat for our condolences. I remember when my father-in-law passed away, I knew what was going to happen. Food was going to start arriving at my mother-in-law's home. So while they were making arrangements, I went home and got in her refrigerator and cleaned out. It needed it to. I cleaned out. I had the refrigerator stripped down to bare minimum. And you know what? We had overflow food in our fridge, in the neighbor's fridge. We had all this food coming in for condolences. David is doing the same thing, but he's doing it on a national level. I bet they didn't show up with potato salad and a bucket of fried chicken or sub sandwiches or chips and salsa. I bet they showed up with some gold and some silver and some ointment. They showed up prepared to deliver speeches, how Israel is mourning the loss of their king. These men showed up to do diplomatic work. Ambassadors are sent in verses 1 and 2. Verse 3, ambassadors are slandered. Look at how they're received. They did not roll out the red carpet for them. They did not call a press conference. There wasn't a photo op where they shook hands with the king of Ammon. Instead, in verse 3, the princes of the children of Ammon, these are the advisors, the people that are surrounded by Hanan. They said unto Hanan, their lord, here's what they said. Thinkest thou that David doeth honor thy father, that he hath sent comforters unto thee? Hath not David rather sent his servants unto thee to search the city, to spy it out, and to overthrow it? Let me tell you something. We don't have any record of David sending spies out to do anything like that ever before. David fights, and battles come to David. David's not out being crafty. David's not sneaking around. David's not out trying to figure out how to whip Ammon. If God pitted Israel against Ammon, they would line up and do battle, and God would grant them the victory. David's not skilled in the arts of espionage. What is David known for? He's known for being gracious. He's known for recognizing leaders. He refused to kill the king that was over him. Two different occasions, if you'll remember. He refused to kill King Saul when he had every opportunity. And manly speaking, worldly speaking, he had every right to. David has a history of grace. David has a history of mercy. David has a history of being peaceful to those who are peaceful to him. And these men show up and say, your father was kind to our king. And our king, David, is a man of his word, is a man of honor, is a man of justice, is a man who is not crafty and sneaky in trying to usurp authority. They chose to listen to these advisors. They chose to listen to these people who slandered David and slandered his ambassadors. And they said, you're here as spies. You're here to seek out our city. You came here for the express purpose of undermining our authority and coming back and attacking us. This is not in keeping with David's character. It's not in keeping with anything in David's history. This is completely and totally made up and fabricated. So, how are these ambassadors treated? Thanks, but no thanks. You're not welcome in our city. We don't trust you, and we don't trust David. No, that's not what happened. The ambassadors that are sent are slandered, and then, point number three, I told you they're short points. They're abused and scorned. They're abused and scorned. Look at it with me. Verse 4. Wherefore Hanan took David's servants and shaved off one half of their beards and cut off their garments in the middle, even at their buttocks, and sent them away. Some of y'all were alive before me. Back in the early 70s, it was popular for men to grow big sideburns. Remember that? Mutton chops, lamb chops, big chop sideburns. My Uncle Donnie was about 17, was growing a pretty good set of big old mutton chops. He was going to get his picture taken in the yearbook with big old sideburns, you know, in high school. My grandpa was a high and tight man himself, clean shaven, high and tight. Had three boys, would take them down to the barber shop, and they'd all get day one military issue haircuts, you know. So they went to the barber shop, and everybody got their haircut, but Donnie. Donnie said, no, we're not giving me a high and tight. You're going to take a little bit off the edges and leave my sideburns alone. So the barber looked at my grandpa, and my grandpa shrugged his shoulders and said, okay. So Donnie felt like he had accomplished something. You know, he's his own man. He's 17 years old. He went to bed that night, and my grandpa went in there with a straight razor and shaved one sideburn off. And he went to the bathroom, and he saw that he had a big old perfect sideburn on the left side, but the right side was shaved off. And he said, why'd you do this? He said, because I wanted to watch you shave the other one. And he did. Do you know how shameful he felt? He was a 17-year-old kid. These are grown men. These aren't 24-year-old men. These are older men who are carrying out an official mission for the nation of Israel under the greatest king on the face of the earth at this time, David. And beards weren't something that you just grew to look cool. At this particular time, your beard was something that people swore by. I swear by my beard. That meant if it was a lie, you had to shave your face. Do you know some cultures at this time, only free men could shave their face? I mean, could grow a beard. If you were a slave, you had to have a clean shaven face, and that signified that you were under the authority of someone else. For Ammon to hold down these grown dignitaries and shave off half of their beard and leave the other half full length was the most humiliating and most disgusting thing you could do. Could you imagine somebody holding down the congressmen and the vice presidents of our country, holding down senators and shaving half their face in a foreign country in front of the news media and mocking them and then sending them back to America? What do you think our response would be to someone like that? Especially if we were coming with foreign aid to help them. I know what my response would be if I was sitting in the Oval Office. Lock and load, gas up the planes, we've got work to do. Not only was their beard shaved off, their clothes were cut off in the middle. Now, if you're one of these people that think that men wear pants and women wear dresses, you're going to have real trouble right here. Each one of these people had a beard. Wonder what sex they are. This is before you could be whatever gender you wanted. This was back in the old days when there were two genders. I wonder what gender these people were that had big long beards. Well, they were men. Notice that their garments were cut in the middle. They didn't make Daisy Duke shorts out of their Wranglers. These men wore full-length robes. You might call them a gown. For you to advocate that men wear pants and women wear dresses is for you to not understand that when this book was written, they all wore the same thing. You know what's interesting to me? Most of the people that advocate men wearing pants and women wearing dresses also say it's bad for a man to have facial hair. The God-given identifier of whether you're male and female should be removed by the modern-day legalist, and the original clothing of mankind has been stripped and classified into two different groups. These guys' clothes were cut off where their rear end showed. They walked out naked. Not because their clothes were taken away, but because their clothes were ruined. This is a show that they stripped them and could have killed them, but decided to shame them instead. This is nothing more than abuse and scorn. They abused them physically by holding them down and shaving their beards and cutting their garments, and they scorned them and showed their disdain, not just for these ambassadors that came, they showed their disdain for that nation and their king, David. The ambassadors are sent, the ambassadors are slandered, then we have abuse and scorn. Number four. This is what happens when God's people are treated that way. Number four, acknowledgement of sin. Acknowledgement of sin. Look with me at verse 5. And when they told it unto David, he sent to meet them because the men were greatly ashamed. And the king said, tarry at Jericho until your beards be grown and then return. The king sent his ambassadors out to the enemies of Israel. And when they were abused, they were sent back and told to recover among God's people at Jericho. If you will remember, Jericho was the first city captured when they crossed the Jordan River. When God's ambassadors are abused before the world, they find comfort and restoration among the cities of God or among the churches of God today. It's the application here. And David said, you stay here until your beards grow back and you're not ashamed to come back into town, then you return. David could have made this a national media attention. David could have brought these men back and said, look what Ammon did to them. David didn't respond rashly. David didn't respond with immediate anger and vengeance. David knew what happened. He acknowledged it was sin, but he didn't immediately give the consequences of that sin. I would have. But our God is not like man. He's not like me. Our God is patient, long-suffering, slow to anger. We're not. We're not like him. So there's the acknowledgement of sin by David, and that's representative of God knowing what happened here. There's also the acknowledgement of sin in the first part of verse 6 by Ammon. Look at what they said. And I like the King James better than any other version right here. I like the wording. And when the children of Ammon saw that they stank before David, stank with an A. I've looked at other translations when they were repulsive before David. No, they were a stench in David's nostrils. God sometimes says that you are a stench in my nostrils. You're a smell I can't get rid of. Have you ever smelt something and you can't unsmell it? Huh? Isn't that awful? You're like, man, light a candle, spray something. I can't get the smell out. You ever smelt something so bad you could taste it? Boy, all of you have experienced these things. The children of Ammon know that the way they treated these ambassadors, David received it like a stink that he could taste. David received it like something that he had complete and total disdain for. And David, in his response, in this acknowledgement of sin, is not immediate. He says, you stay here till your beards grow back. Get you some clothes. Get your beards grown back. You come back later. They get word that, hey, David was serious. He was trying to help you. You know what they should have done? You know what they should have done? They should have sent some ambassadors to Jerusalem and said, hey, sorry about that. Can we get a mulligan? Can we get a do-over? Is that what they did? No. The enemies of God never respond with humility. They never respond with repentance. They never respond with, we're sorry, forgive us. The enemies of God always double down on what they do. So let's look at point number 5. Allies are sought. Look at the latter part of verse 6 with me. When they saw that they stank before David, the children of Ammon sent and hired Syrians of Beth Rehob and Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 footmen, and of King Maacah, 1,000 men, and of Ishtob, 12,000 men. Is that 33,000 men? Something close to that? Plus all the men that are in Ammon. This is a sizable army. These allies that are sought, they listened to the world, and the world said, don't trust David. When they mocked and despised David's ambassadors and they abused them and sent them back and they saw that they had offended David and they saw that they had guessed wrong, instead of crying out for mercy, they surrounded themselves with those who also hate David. They surrounded themselves with those who are also the enemies of David. Folks, it is no different. When those who reject God also gather around them others that reject God. You ever heard the old saying, birds of a feather flock together? That's exactly what's happening here. They realize they're in trouble. They realize they're outnumbered. And they go to hiring mercenaries. Has David invaded them? No. Has David went to war with them? No. They are preemptive in their hatred and disdain and readiness to fight against David. It's their choice to engage in this war. Point number 6, armed struggle. Who started the armed struggle? Ammon. Ammon called up mercenaries and lined them up at the border of Israel. Ammon is the one that said, we're now going to war with Israel. Ammon is the one that abused and mocked and scorned the ambassadors of Israel. Ammon is the aggressor every single time against David. The same could be true of Satan and God. It was not God who first attacked Lucifer, the star of the morning. It was Lucifer, the star of the morning, that rose up against our God and took a third of the heavenly host with him and rebelled against our God. It is Lucifer that was cast to the earth. It was Satan in the form of a serpent that went and attacked Eve. It was Satan that went and approached Christ in the time of temptation in the wilderness. The aggressor has always been the same. Satan. God is not the aggressor. God is merciful. God is gracious. God extends mercy. It is always the enemies of God that attack and form alliances and go into an armed struggle. The forces of God. You look at verses 7 through 18. We're going to cover these rather quickly. I want you to see what takes place after these guys have assaulted David's men, and they know they've sinned against him. You look at verses 7 and 8 of this armed struggle, I want you to see the response. When David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the host of the mighty men. This is the first time we hear about David's mighty men. This is an elite army. This is not the general army. This is not the draft. These are guys that are full-time military servants. Within this list of mighty men are men that have killed 800 men by themselves at one time. 300 men by themselves at one time. This is before grape shot. This is before cannons. This is before Claymore mines. This is before missiles. There are men in this group of mighty men who with hand instruments, swords and spears, in one day killed 800 men. Can you imagine fighting 800 men and killing all 800 and living to tell about it? We write books about guys who with sniper rifles kill 25 guys. 25 guys from over a half a mile away. These men killed 800 at arm's reach. Well, this is like, it's not the General Army. This is like the Green Berets, the Navy SEALs, combat controllers. These are a special forces unit, a sizable unit, but not the whole army of Israel. David's response at this point in time is not to declare all-out war on Ammon. David's response is to restore order and remove the threat of Ammon toward him. When we look the next verse, verse 7, we see in verse 7, David's response. Look with me at verse 8. And the children of Ammon came out and put in battle array at the entering of the gate, and the Syrians of Zoab and Rehob and Ishtob and Maacah were themselves in the field. So when Israel rode up, Ammon comes out of the city gates and establishes a perimeter in front of the city. And then over here on this hill and around behind the children of Israel, all of the mercenaries from Syria and from Maacah and from Ishtob, all of the 33,000 men surround Israel. So we have a walled city with soldiers there that live in the city, and we have 33,000 mercenaries behind us. That is the response. Let's look at the resolve. You got to admire General Joab here. You want to talk about a military, you want to talk about a guy that looked like old blood and guts? That was Joab. That was Joab. Look at his resolve in verses 9 through 12. When Joab saw that the front of the battle was against him, before and behind, he chose all the choice men of Israel and put them in array against the Syrians. Joab surrounded. You know what most people do when they're surrounded? Let's see if we can talk our way out of it. Let's everybody get together and try to break through one set of lines and get away. Let's find a way to retreat. We're surrounded. Joab sees all that and he says, all right, I want all the best of you to line up against the paid professional soldiers. These are mercenaries. These are trained men. These are Hessians who travel around the world hunting people and fighting in wars for money. Professional soldiers. I want all my best men to fight these 33,000 professional soldiers. Then look at verse 10. The rest of the people he delivered in the hand of Abisha, his brother, that he might put them in array against the children of Ammon. So he takes his brother and all the common lesser soldiers in this elite group of fighters and says, all you guys fight the homeboys. We're going to go fight the mercenaries. You see this? And where does Joab put himself? I'll stay here in the middle and see who's doing the best. No, Joab said, I'm leading them against the superior army. He's just like General George Patton, old blood and guts. He's not afraid of a fight. He wants to fight to the death. He has confidence. Now listen, not confidence in his army. Patton had confidence in his army, in his leadership. Joab had confidence in his God. Here's the difference. He said, if the Syrians be too strong for me, then thou shalt help me. But if the children of Ammon be too strong for thee, then I will come and help thee. Whichever one of us is winning, try to help the other one. Key verse right here, verse 12. Be of good courage. And let us play the men for our people. Let us fight like men. Let us be men. Let us stand up. Let us quit acting like kids. We're not out here in a Girl Scout camp. This is war. And we're going to go to war, and we're going to fight like men. And here's why. We're going to fight like men for our people. We're fighting for our own homes. We're fighting for our own families. We're fighting for the cities of our God, he said. We're fighting for the nation of Israel, God's chosen people in God's chosen country. And the Lord do that which seemeth him good. Let's go out and do what soldiers are supposed to do, and let's trust that God does what God wants to do and what's best for God's people. Friend, you can approach any conflict with that advice right there. That advice right there. Be of good courage. I'm doing this for the glory of God. I'm doing this for God's people. I'm going to go out and do what's right and trust God to handle the outcome. With that resolve right there, you're never surrounded. With that resolve right there, God is in your army and he's leading it. That brings us to 13 in the first part of verse 14, the rout. We're looking at the armed struggle. They went out and hired 33 mercenaries. They said, David won't get us now. They surrounded David's men, his smaller elite army. They surrounded them. They said, we got you where we want you. Look at what happened. And Joab drew nigh, leading his army with courage, with conviction. The people that were with him unto the battle against the Syrians, and they fled before him. This small army of Israel never fired a shot. They lined up against superior numbers. They lined up against superior troops. And they showed no fear because their confidence was in God. And they walked them down and they ran from them. They ran from them. How many times in your own life do you get all worried about the outcome when you've yet to line up across the enemy and start approaching him? How many times do you what if yourself to death in conflict or in struggle? What's going to happen? How am I going to handle this? How am I going to handle that? I tell you what, why don't you quit worrying about all that? Tamp a bullet down there on top of the powder, put a cap on that musket, and head to the enemy. Are you doing the Lord's work? Are you doing it on behalf of the Lord's people? Then quit worrying about it, quit wondering about it, and go take action. These guys didn't even have to swing a sword. They walked out on the battlefield and said, we're here on behalf of our God. You're in trouble. And they said, you're right. And they left. No shots fired. Well, what happened when the 33,000 paid mercenaries took off running? People of Ammon were out there by the gate going, hey, how's the mercenaries doing? Well, there's a cloud of dust going over the hill. Now, you remember what Joab said? If these guys are too strong for you, we'll come and help you fight. But when Ammon saw Syrians running away, when they saw their paid army faltered in battle and fled from the scene, the children of Ammon went back inside their city gate and locked and bolted the door. That's what it said. Verse 14, and when the children of Ammon saw the Syrians had fled, they fled also before Abisha and entered into the city. So under this armed struggle, we see the response of both sides. We see the resolve of Joab and God's people. We see a rout. Now we see, oddly enough, a return. If I'm Joab, I'm like, let's light some arrows and shoot them into this city and burn it down. Let's get a battering ram and bust down the door. Let's come out at night with some dark op stuff and throw a hook up on the wall and crawl over at night and rout them. Joab doesn't do any of that. This amazes me. Look at what happened at the latter part of verse 15. So Joab returned from the children of Ammon and came to Jerusalem. Joab didn't go out there to completely annihilate those who had sinned against David. Joab went out there to squash a little rebellion. Now, the Syrians who were hired to fight against Israel showed up, quickly ran away. You know what the Syrians said? Now we're in trouble. We sided with the wrong team. We sent a whole group of people out to fight with Ammon, and y'all ran. Now we are the natural born enemies of David again. David's already defeated the Syrians once. So you know what they said? All hands on deck. If you look at verses 15 through 18, we'll look at them real quickly. The Syrians saw they were smitten before Israel, and they gathered themselves together. And had a razor sent and brought the Syrians that were beyond the river. So remember, they only had 20,000 people there? They had 20,000 people. He said, we need all hands on deck. He called up everybody from beyond the river. The entire Syrian army, all their chariots, all their horses, they're all here. They're in a battle array against Jordan. They set themselves in battle array. Verse 17, David gathered all of Israel. This wasn't just a group of mighty men. This was all hands on deck for Israel as well. If Syria is going to go all in, David's going all in. David didn't pick the battle with Syria. The Syrians did. David didn't pursue the Syrians. The Syrians came and regrouped and assaulted David. I've said all along, it's not God out tearing down Satan. It's Satan out attacking God's people. It's always been that way. Verse 18, and the Syrians fled before Israel. And David slew of the men 700 chariots of the Syrians and 40,000 horsemen and smote Shobak, the captain of their host, who died there. Their top general died. Thousands, 40,000 horsemen, 700 chariots, all at a loss. Verse 19, and when all the kings that were servants of Hadarezer saw that they were smitten before Israel, they made peace with Israel and served them. So the Syrians feared to help the children of Ammon anymore. Retribution for those who rebel against a holy God. Retribution for those who rebel against God's chosen king. So the armed struggle ends and Ammon is still in their city. Ammon is still inside the walls. They've despised God's David's ambassadors. Representative of God's servants, they've despised them. They've pushed them aside. Now notice what happens in the very first verse of chapter 11. And when we look at chapter 11, we're getting ready for David and Bathsheba, right? We're going to see David for the first time not look like a superhero, but look like a regular old human being capable of doing dumb stuff. And so everybody reads verse 1, and this is what they focus on. But David tarried still at Jerusalem. David should have went off to war. David should have led his men in battle. David shouldn't be at home on the rooftop looking at naked women in the neighbor's yard. But here's what they overlook. Look at verse 1 at the first. And it came to pass after the year was expired. There's certain times to go to war and there's certain times you shouldn't go to war. You should go to war in the springtime when food is abundant. You should go to war in the springtime when those other countries that you are fighting are trying to get their crops in the ground and harvest their first fruits. You should go to war in the springtime when you have food for your army and you can inflict maximum damage on their army. And it came to pass after a year was expired, at the time when kings go forth to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with them, all Israel, no more just mighty, mighty men. This is full-out army, just like whipped the Syrians. Full-out army, all Israel, and they destroyed who? Children of Ammon. And what? And besieged Rabbah. That's the city where the Ammonites were out there in array of battle, and Joab and Abisha pushed them back inside and left and went back to Jerusalem. Well, our last point is this. There is an appointed season. That first little armed struggle, that first little armed conflict, that was just to resolve the immediate issues of the day and restore order. Later on, at the appointed time, when battles take place, Joab showed up with the whole army and wiped out all of Ammon and pushed them all into one city and besieged it. I said, preacher, where are you going there? Here's where I'm going. David didn't initially wipe out Ammon for their sins. David just put an end to the struggle. But David didn't forget their sin, did he? David didn't forget what they'd done to his ambassadors, did he? David didn't forget that they hired 32,000 mercenaries to come and fight against Israel. David didn't forget that they helped pick a battle against Syria. David did not forget their sins and the sins of their accomplices. And when the appointed time arose, David said, "Now we're going to deal with you, Ammon. Now we're not going to come out and make a showing and go back to Israel. Now we're going to come out and utterly destroy you from the face of the earth." Say, "Brother Harold, what's all this about? That's a neat story. I like how David wins in the end. I always like a good Western where the white hat guy wins, you know. This is a great story. Oh, but friend, listen to me. Ammon and Hanan were rejectors not only of David's grace, but rejectors of God's grace. If we take the outline, my little 7-point silly outline, all starting with the same letters, we're going to see that that's exactly how people reject God's grace and exactly how God deals with them. Let's look at it and we'll close. Ambassadors are sent. God does the same thing to the enemies around him at times when they are susceptible to being helped. You'll remember Hanan here is grieving over the death of his father. His heart is tender. He's receptive to hearing some comforting words. God at the same time sends gospel preachers, and he sends them to those who may not even be his friends. Do you know when gospel preachers show up? At funerals. Isn't it funny? You got a guy laying here in a box who didn't care a thing in the world about anything that had to do with God. And when he died, his family said, "Oh, we need a preacher to come talk to us." Why? He didn't want to hear a preacher. Probably does now, but it's too late. So now, at the death of a loved one, God sends grace. He sends gospel preachers. And God sends gospel preachers, and they've been sent all around the world. They've been sent to every tribe. They've been sent to every race. They've been sent to every nation. They've been sent to every city. God's preachers have gone around the globe and around the globe and around the globe, and they're still going around the globe. Everywhere they get kicked out, gospel preachers get sent back. Ambassadors are sent. How are these ambassadors treated? Same way these were treated by those that reject the grace of God. Ambassadors are slandered. Satan lies about God's preachers. Satan lies about God's preachers. The world lies about God's preachers. It's funny how people will go and hear the gospel preached. And just at hearing the gospel preached, they will say, "Man, that's so true. You know, that makes perfect sense. I understand it." And then they will go consult someone that they've been running around with, someone that they live with, someone that they respect in the world, and they will start to share with them what they heard about God and His wonderful gospel of how Christ came to save sinners. And their friends, their advisors, the people around them go, "Oh, don't believe that. That preacher don't want to save you. He wants to enslave you. God wants to take all the fun stuff away." I remember witnessing to an old friend of mine, and he said, "Harold, I'd like to get saved, but I don't want to quit drinking. If I got saved, I'd have to quit drinking." I said, "Well, why don't you just get saved first and let the drinking take care of itself?" "Oh, I don't want to give that up. I like it too much. I don't want to start living like that. I don't want to start doing those things." Grace by the ambassador is perceived as greed by the associates. David said, "I'm coming to comfort you. Here's men from my kingdom." And the people around him said, "They're coming after our stuff. They want to take over our nation. They want to ruin our way of life. They want to overthrow you as king." When the gospel is preached to people, the world around them, Satan lies to them through the world and says, "Oh no, that's not grace, it's greed. That preacher wants your money. That preacher wants your allegiance. That preacher wants your attendance. He's not concerned about your soul." abused and scorned. Disdain for God can only be expressed by disdain for God's preachers and people. Atheist. Their motto is, there is no God and I hate him. Right? But since they can't express their hatred on a God they can't wrap their hands around, they express their hatred of God to you. And more so to those who carry the gospel message to them. Friend, if the church just stayed inside the walls and we just talked about God to each other and we didn't engage anybody out here in the world and we didn't engage anybody on Facebook or Instagram or YouTube or social media, we just stayed huddled up here in the walls, the world would leave us alone. But as soon as we start trying to reach our former enemies, those who wanted to gouge out the eyeballs of our forefathers, just like this king did, when we start engaging our enemies with the good news of Jesus Christ, because we are his ambassadors, the hatred that they have for God is expressed toward us who carry the gospel. Abuse and scorn is the way that God's people have always been treated and always will be treated as long as sin abounds on the earth. Jesus said so. If they hate you, know that they hated me first. Acknowledgement of sin. You remember in verse 5 and 6, David said, I know what they did. Grow your beard out. Time's coming. We'll deal with them. Can I tell you something? God knows how you've responded to his ambassador. God knows what you're thinking while I'm preaching. That should either comfort you or terrify you. David knew what happened to these men he sent. David didn't say, oh, don't worry about it. They're just old rotten sinners. Don't worry. That's just what people do. No, David said, no. This is serious. We're going to deal with it. Their time is coming. David knew. God knows. He knows what you think when the gospel's preached. He knows if you're dying to get out of here. He knows if you're bored out of your mind. He knows if you've got 100 other thoughts and this ain't one of them. He knows if you're not interested in his word. He knows if you're not interested in his people. And he knows what you think about his preachers. Now, I don't. You guys all smile at me and put your hand out and go, great sermon today. And I go, all right, good. But I'm just a dumb hillbilly. I can be fooled. Our God has flaming eyes that pierce even into your soul. He knows the thoughts and intentions of your heart. You may never hold down a preacher and shave half his beard off or cut his pants off, but if you've thought it in your mind, our God knows. There's an acknowledgement of sin, and he's not forgot it. Here's what else. You know if you're a stink in the nostrils of God. You know where you stand before God. You may fool me. You may fool everybody else in the building. You may fool grandma. You may fool the kids. You may fool everybody else. But deep down inside, you know where you stand with God. You know what you think. You know on the inside, just like they knew that they had done wrong. They knew they mishandled these ambassadors. They knew that David hated them. You know where you stand with God. You know. And God knows. There's an acknowledgement of sin. Here's what happens when you know that. You have two options. You can go running up to David's kingdom. Sorry about that, man. What do we got to do to make this right? We really messed this whole thing up. We should have. Where are those guys at? I want to personally buy them all new suits. I want to get them members of the hair club for men. I want to help their beards grow back. I want to do all I can possibly do to make this right. Or you can do what most people who reject the grace of God do. You can surround yourself with people who agree with you. Mercenaries against our God can be bought. They're easy. I come up 59 Highway this morning. 9 o'clock. I don't normally come to church this late, but since we're not having Sunday school, there's no need me being down here at 6 a.m. So I'm coming to church closer to the time that church starts. And I'm coming up 59 Highway, and you know what I see? Trailer after trailer after trailer. And you know what's on those trailers? Big old knobby, tired, rock-crawling side-by-sides. You ever seen them? Big, jacked up. You know where they're all going? They're all going up Highway 59 to the National Forest to trail ride. You say, Brother Harold, are they the enemies of God? Well, they ain't meeting with God's people. And there's a big crowd of them up there. And they're going to tell you, man, you're missing out if you're spending time down there listening to that old ambassador of God. You ought to be up here living life. YOLO, you only live once. That preacher said, we're not going to ride rock crawlers in heaven. You better get it all in now. Hey, newsflash, mister, you're not going to ride them in hell either. Might get ran over by one down there, but you're not going to be driving any. You will find a ton of people who will come to your aid, pat you on the back, and say, we don't believe that mess either. Pick your party. There's 100 groups out here protesting. They will gladly take you if you hate God too. There are 100 groups who will align with you. There are 100 groups that will stand with you. There are 100 places you could be. There are 100 places you could go. Your arms struggle. You've got your allies. You've offended God's messenger. You've thumbed your nose at God. Here's what's happened. God's not going to come wipe you completely out. He'll just come and win a little bit. He'll keep you in check. He'll come run you back in your house. And then you'll get mad at God for the way he treated you. You'll be embarrassed just like those Syrians were. When you lined up on the wrong side and God slapped you for it and he put you in your place and he chastened you and put you back where you rightly belong, then you will become mad at God and you will summon all the forces of God that you have around you and you'll go to battle with him. And you know what? You'll lose just like the Syrians did. None can stand against our God. You may be worldly successful. You may have nice stuff. But you will not be able to stand against a holy God. Just as these armies weren't able to stand against David. But friend, here's the real problem. It's not the armed struggle. At some point in the armed struggle, you can fall down on your knees and say, God, have mercy on me. There's an appointed season. Each and every single one of you have an appointment with God. I saw the cardiologist last week. They made me an appointment for 6 months from now. Wrote it on a card like I'm keeping this little business card that says March 12th, 9:30. Each of you have an appointment card that you ain't seen yet. And it says appointment with the God whose ambassadors you've abused and mistreated. Appointment with the God who you've allied to fight against. Appointment with the God who you've been in armed struggle with. Appointment with God upon your death to stand before him and give an account for every idle word that's came out of your mouth. You have that appointment and you know it. You know it. How many of you do not think that you're going to physically die one day? The Lord doesn't return. Every single one, brother, how nobody's doubting that we're all going to die one day. Have you listened to your friends to the point that you no longer believe you're going to stand before God on that day? Listen, every culture out there, every religion out there believes that when you die, you face God in some form or another. You know why? Mankind knows that God exists and knows that he will stand before him. You have an appointed season. Let me give you two paths you can take. Let's contrast Mephibosheth and Hanan, king of the Ammonites. Mephibosheth heard grace. Hanan heard greed. He's not trying to help you, son. He's trying to take over your kingdom. Mephibosheth responded in humility. Hanan responded in hostility. You can take either path. You can hear God's grace being offered to you, or you can see God is greedy, wanting what you have. You can respond in humility and say, "Who am I that you would be so kind to a dead dog like me?" Or you can take the ambassador that God sent you and shave half his beard off and cut his clothing off and send him about his way. Mephibosheth was fed at the king's table. Hanan was fought by the king's army. You can pick your path, friend. You can go either way you want. Mephibosheth was saved. Hanan was slaughtered. Mephibosheth received grace. Hanan rejected grace. You can do whichever way you want. It's all in how you perceive the ambassador that God sent you and the message he offered you. How will you respond to his ambassador is how you respond to God. Now, friend, I know I'm the preacher here. But I got to be honest with you. If you have a low view of preachers, gospel preachers, you have a low view of God. There are churches that have a low view of their pastor. They simply see him as a hireling, somebody that performs a service for them. They give him a small amount of money and send him on his way, keep him in his place, tell him to stay out of their business. Those churches not only have a low view of God's ambassador, they have a low view of God. You can say one thing, but in your heart, you know how you feel about me and other gospel preachers whom God has sent to evangelize the world. You know where you send your money. You know where you spend your time. Who will you listen to? Will you listen to the ambassadors of God? Or will you listen to the assistants of Hanan? Who will you align with? Will you side with Israel? Will you go and line up with the kingdom of David? Or will you side with the Syrians? Line up with Hadarezer? How can you oppose God? You know He exists. You know He's real. You know you're going to stand before Him. How long do you plan to oppose God? You have an appointment with him, and you know it. Now let me give you some advice. Humble yourself right now before your king. If you've smited his ambassadors before, fall down on your knees and say, "Have mercy." That same merciful God that sent you the ambassador, that sent you the gospel, that called you into himself, that same God will receive you now just like he would have received you then. He's quick to forgive. He longs to show mercy. He's loving. You know what the problem is? It's not this great God that you're at odds with. It's you. You refuse to come to this God because you've listened to the people around you. You've bought the lies of Satan in the world. You've aligned with the enemy. You've hired mercenaries to be around you, to insulate you from God. But this appointment's coming, and right now, I beg you, I plead with you, I implore you. Humble yourself before God like Mephibosheth did. And repent. Believe the gospel. What's the gospel? Real quick, you've heard it before. I'm not looking at any new faces in here. Jesus Christ, sin free, came to earth, never sinned, died on a cross. Even though he didn't deserve to death, he died there, unworthy of death, so that we who are worthy of the wrath and punishment and eternal death of God, Christ died in our place.
He is our eternal sin bearer. God treated Jesus, who was without sin, his own son, like he should have treated me, Harold Smith. And since he treated Christ like he should have treated me, he can treat me like Jesus Christ. What will you do with that message? My advice, repent and believe it. Don't see it as God wanting to take everything away from you and make you some kind of little peon in his kingdom. Don't see it as some preacher up here trying to control you and bring you in to some little kingdom that the preacher's created. See it as who you really are in the appointment you have before you. And that loving God now, through this ambassador, inviting you to cease being his enemy and become his own son, and to eat at his table continually, and be forever preserved by him. I pray that's who you are. Be a recipient of God's grace, and not a rejecter of God's grace. Let's stand.